Hey guys, I'm Tawny, founder of Sobriety Tea Party and Readings on Recovery.
And I'm Lisa, author of Girl Walks Out of a Bar. And welcome to our podcast,
Recovery Rocks. We're going to talk to you about everything from recovery to rock and roll to living in New York City.
We're going to talk about how we got sober, why we got sober, and how we stay sober.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to Recovery Rocks.
Welcome. I'm Tawny.
I'm Lisa.
And we're going to talk about the evolution of our of sobriety and recovery, really.
Yes.
And like maybe how our perspectives of sobriety and recovery have evolved, and maybe even just like the whole sobriety world is evolving.
Well, that's very true.
You know?
Right. How it has changed for us and overall over the course of our recovery. I am sober almost 15 years.
Woohoo. Yes, I was drinking coffee
she
and cheering
drinking coffee
at the same time.
And pumping her fist.
Fist pump. I lived in Jersey for 2 years, so I can fist pump.
I grew up in Jersey. So I mean, it definitely changes. One huge thing that has changed for me is that when I got sober, I didn't know anybody sober. I didn't know anything about it. I ended up checking myself into detox, and I immediately went into an outpatient rehab, intensive outpatient at night, because I insisted on going back to work. And I went straight to 12-step meetings, because at that time in 2004, it was 12-step or nothing. Like, if you were going to stop drinking, you were going to 12-step, or, you know, you were going to continue drinking.
Yeah, those were the only options.
Basically, what I was told, like, you have to do this or you will not be able to stay sober. I personally believe that for me, I needed to do it to stay sober. But there was certainly no, you know, it was all very, very in the shadows. Mm-hmm. It was a big secret.
Shame and stigma.
Oh, yeah. People didn't talk about it. I certainly didn't share it with people outside of my my circle. I didn't share it in the office. I never felt, you know, I was really frankly proud of it, and I thought it was kind of badass in a Keith Richards kind of way.
Yes.
You know, like when I got put on meds in the detox, I thought that was very cool. So it has, for me, over time, it has become this thing where I see people like you and like other people much younger than me who are very, very much own it and not 12-step, however they do it. And I totally think however you do it is great. And, you know, really proud of it. And I think rightfully so. It's something to be proud of.
Yeah, I agree, obviously, because I'm doing that. But it's also, I think it's cool that it's evolved in many ways. The scene has evolved, our relationships to recover. We as people have evolved,
sure.
Right? But I remember, I think what's, you know, I'm not an AA person. I've been to meetings. I'll go every once in a while, but it's not part of my,
you're not doing the 12 step
program.
I'm not
doing the steps, and it's not really my jam. But I will say that that's something I've evolved on. Is I was like almost vehemently anti-AA my first couple years, my first two years.
I think it's really common, yeah.
I was just like, I mean, I could list anecdotes of why, but we all have reasons.
Right.
But I was turned off by the almost like the, maybe the routine or the rigidity of like, okay, like you quit drinking, you do this now. You stopped, you do this, you do this, you do this. I didn't like that. I don't like rules. I don't want someone telling me what I need to do.
Yeah. It is like that. There are, and nothing is a rule. There's no rules. They're all just suggestions, but I mean,
but it's
if
the people.
You want to follow, oh, a lot of people, there are.
That's
well,
the
there's
thing.
A spectrum, right? Because
that's
like for
me,
I'm not, I've never felt that way, but there is, you know, I'm very accepting of, I think it's great whoever does their thing, however they do it. I think more power to them, and that's amazing. In any case, in any way, you stay sober. But there are definitely the the kind of zealots mm-hmm. who go over it. And it's unfortunate because they drive great people away who could really, benefit from other aspects of the program.
Well, in doing this podcast with you in season one, your tolerance, your open-mindedness tore away some of my my own issues with AA. I was like, okay, if this is the program that Lisa uses, if this is why, it's not why you're cool, because you go because of the program that you work, but I'm like, Lisa's cool and
join
she
AA,
does,
become cool.
Yeah.
Said no one ever,
but like this is Lisa and she's cool as hell and she does this.
Says Tom.
So it's like, it says most people.
Yeah. All right.
I can literally
keep going.
I can hear your fans outside banging on the windows because
God.
I love you so
much.
Oh
my God.
But
oh my God.
I was like, okay, if this is what Lisa does and it not only works for her, but it helps her on on a fundamental, it's changed her life on a fundamental
basis.
Oh yeah,
on a daily basis. Different.
I'll give it another shot, and I did. And again, it's not 100% my jam. I'll go every once in a while. There's a great meeting in my neighborhood. I'll go maybe once every 2 months, and it's nice.
Right.
It's really nice. And I will say my early recovery was quite arrogant.
See, this is why it's interesting to talk about how it evolved.
Yeah.
Because mine was quite fearful, but you talk about yours.
Mine was quite arrogant. I think because I was so anti 12 step. That I took this punk rock, still addict out attitude of like, I'm not going to follow what anyone tells me to do. I'm going to do it on my own. I don't need this. I'm different. All the stuff we tell ourselves, the same, similar things we tell ourselves to keep using. I told myself to stay out of meetings. And, I found Road Recovery, and I found, okay, this is what works for me. This is great. And that opened up my eyes to, wow, I've been going to support groups twice a week now, and I feel really good. Yeah. Like, this is really nice. This is what I was missing. Mm-hmm. And I say I was arrogant before because I was like, I don't need support groups. I don't need this. I have Instagram and I have the blog and I have events and it's like, I'm doing all of this stuff, which is great. Like nothing to knock, not going to knock those things, but it was also, it was quite, independent and independent in a bad way, isolating,
like rebellious.
Yeah.
Rebellious recovery, which is like, wouldn't typically like think of it like that. But did you... It's interesting because it's like you were like what that makes me think of, like when you say like arrogant or whatever, or I'll do this my way or whatever. I was so afraid, like if I ever tried to do anything my way, I would just be drinking immediately. Like I'm sure part of it was because at the time there was no one else doing anything else.
Well, yeah, it was because it's been 15 years now, you said, and this recovery landscape has changed incredibly just in the last couple of years. It's crazy how many options are out there, both online and in person. There's tons of support groups now that are not AA.
Right. And how important do you think, like for you in early recovery, how important do you think, like whether it was not a formal support group like Road Recovery or a non like Instagram and the things you're doing, how necessary was it for you to be plugged into a community?
Absolutely. Like non-negotiable, this is what I need.
Right.
And I think that that's why I started. So my sobriety began as a year-long journey or as a year-long social experiment. I was like, I'm not going to drink for a year and I'm going to blog about it and this is going to be what I do. I knew that I needed something to keep me accountable.
Yeah.
Whereas most people,
they
have a buddy or they go to a meeting. I turned it into a show.
Yeah.
And I was just going to do, I was like, this is what I'm going to do for a year.
Yeah.
And here we are 3 years later and we have a podcast. And
you're like a voice in recovery.
And I do an event series and it's really weird. But I wouldn't recommend that. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. Do not do that. It was incredibly, I feel like it was pretty arrogant, but
but you had no fear in you that like your approach would mean you were going to pick up.
No, because I
was, you felt like the accountability.
I had
was
that accountability.
Having
I was
to
like,
show up, so it was insurance.
Yeah, like yeah. I'm very public and open about this. I'm not doing this for a year, so why would I have a drink?
Right.
And then that year ended, and I was like, oh, I'm actually feeling pretty good. I'm going to keep this going. And so, like, I've always been out. My recovery has always been
right.
out loud.
Right.
So the thought of it being private, I don't know yeah. what that's like.
Yeah.
But I do find it attractive. There's times when I think, like, you know, it would be really nice. Like, maybe I just chill out on Instagram and events and stuff mm-hmm. like this, to where maybe I'm just a sober person that is living in New York.
Right.
And I'm not the poster child for it.
Right, right, right.
But
right.
I like to say I'm either balls deep or I'm not in it at all. That's like kind of how I live my life. And it's like, I'm either doing something 110.
You never noticed your balls.
Yeah, you can totally
your
see my
balls. Your figurative balls, I've definitely noticed.
Yeah, my literal balls.
Yeah.
But
your lady balls.
My lady balls, my ovaries.
Yes, that's right. Your hanging ovaries.
My hanging ovaries. But I don't know how to, I do everything 110%
yeah, yeah,
or
yeah.
not at all. Like, yeah. that's just my personality. That's probably an addict trait. That's also like, I'm an only child with no
yeah.
siblings. So I've just always done
yeah,
things
yeah.
my way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I think it's really.
I said with no siblings. Only child with no cousins is what I meant. Only child with no siblings.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even pick that
is
up. Yeah.
Implied.
Yeah. But I think, you know, there was always a part of me, I think, when, you know, what I was ashamed of was the way I drank and drugged. Like, that was the shame to me.
Yeah.
And so when I got sober, I didn't feel shame about getting sober. I felt proud of it, but I felt like it wasn't, you know, like other people didn't understand. Other people were judgy about it, like particularly in the workplace. And so I didn't, you know, I felt kind of secretive about it, but the piece of me that wanted to share it kind of wanted to brag about it, kind of wanted to be like, yeah, you think you know me, but you don't. And there's this whole other thing. And this other thing is really pretty cool, you know, like
yeah.
I have always felt like literally from the time I was in the detox and I was like, you know, I was like, wow, like if I can get through this, like I'm standing here in some, you know, like ratty PJ thing in a psych ward on a lockdown unit lining up for meds, like I can do other things if I can do this.
That's true.
You know what I mean? It gave me, like I didn't think I had it in me to get sober. You know what I mean?
I think
a lot of people who struggle with drugs and alcohol, you know, feel like they couldn't do it. Well, you can, you know,
you can.
And I definitely did not think I ever could. So then when I did, it was like, I felt pretty fucking proud of myself. I still do.
As you should. I mean, this,
as anybody should.
We've talked about this before, but so if you're listening and not watching, the mics that we use for this podcast are on Lisa's coffee table.
Oh, the coffee table.
And the coffee table that Lisa used to do blow on.
A lot of blow.
Now holds the mics for our recovery podcast.
Oh, that's insane. If someone had told me that.
That's so poetic.
Oh my God. If someone had told me that as I was like huddled over. And I used to keep the coffee table pulled really close to the couch so that I could just lean over and do lines off it. And then I would constantly, when I would stand up to go get more wine or whatever it was, I would slam my leg on the corner of the coffee table over and over every time. But God forbid I just moved the coffee table back a little bit, because then I'd have to, you know, actually get up to do the drugs. And
but
I wasn't willing to do that. Like, that's the kind of
That's such
thinking.
A metaphor for our lives at the time, though.
Way.
It's like,
just do it again.
There's these perpetual obstacles that we clearly have control over avoiding, but we just didn't because we prioritized getting fucked up.
Right, we couldn't get out of our own way, literally.
We couldn't. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and look at us now!
Yeah, right. No, but it's true. Like, whenever, I think it's true for anybody who gets sober, it's like you think about how you felt about yourself in those years of go, you know, when you wake up in the morning and go, what happened last night? And I can't believe I did that again. And what did I say to who? And who is this strange person laying next to me? Like,
yeah,
you know, that you think, you know, that's where the shame is to me.
That's a really good point. But it's like, it's almost society sees it the opposite direction, where it's those are punchlines. Like, being hungover is a joke. It's funny.
I know.
And chugging, having wine at breakfast is funny.
I had a lot of wine at a lot of breakfast time, and there was nothing funny about it. It was, and that's one of the things, you know, I speak a lot to lawyers in different contexts, but like one of the things that I actually have to say that always surprises me that I have to say it because it's so intuitive to anybody who's been in the position is that when somebody shows up to work drunk, they're not having fun. That's not because they think it's fun or cool or whatever to show up to work drunk.
You're right.
Nobody wakes up in the morning thinking, I'm going to show up to work drunk today. You know, whatever they're doing is they're doing in terms of something either that got away from them, which is terrible. They went to lunch and they thought they were going to have one glass of wine with their friend and they ended up drinking four and then they came back to the office. Or they literally, if you were like me, couldn't function, could not have gotten to the office without it. Like there, and there was the, I can't remember if we had talked about this, but somebody posted a story on Instagram about a school teacher who was caught with a, you know, drunk in the morning with a bottle of booze in her drawer. And somebody posted that news story and Gwyneth Paltrow wrote in and said, I don't know, sometimes I can't deal with my kids without a drink.
God.
And Gwyneth Paltrow, like, where is, like, she, you know, she got piled on so badly, rightfully so.
Was this recently?
It was, like, within a couple months, maybe.
Wow.
Piled on by the recovery community, rightfully so. Like, that's not a joke. Like, that woman was not... You know, and I get, like that's something to make, like not when you're in a position of influence or you're whatever. That woman was showing up drinking in that classroom because she couldn't help it. You know, that wasn't because she thought it would be a cool, fun thing to do. Or like it was like, oh yeah, I need a drink to deal with these kids. No, that woman needed to drink.
It's sad.
It's really sad. It's really sad.
And Gwyneth Paltrow turns it into a joke. And right. Probably like,
but now it's nice. There is because of this loud vocal recovery community. She got immediately
good
attacked on that.
Good,
yeah, which was good by some of our friends.
Yeah, good. Yeah, we got good friends.
Yeah, we have friends who speak up.
We have good loud advocate friends.
Yeah, yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, literally, when I got sober, it wasn't that long into. I started writing right away. Because I thought like the story was something I wanted to tell. But I remember I didn't know who to, you know, I wasn't even on Facebook. I mean, it was, you know, 15 years ago. And I Googled like cool sober women. And that's how I found Anna David.
Mm.
Anna David, who is our goddess.
You literally Googled queen. Cool sober women.
Yeah. Like cool sober women or cool sober people, whatever.
And her name popped up.
Yeah, because she had written this book, Party Girl.
I love that.
Yeah.
She is a cool sober
woman.
She
is amazing. She's amazing. But like that was how hard it was to, you know, to find. And now, of course, everybody knows Anna David.
Anna's great.
Yeah. But yeah, there's this whole, I feel like there's a much more vocal team out there of all of us. You know, everybody who wants to lend their voice.
There's a huge, we do have a big team. It does. Yeah. I never thought about it in that term, but we've got people all over the world that we
could, no, it's a
that
big
are,
thing.
We're an army of sober, a lot of sober women.
Yeah.
It's predominantly women.
Yeah.
And there's definitely
men
in the scene too, but and men and non-binary, but it's predominantly women, non-binary, queer.
Yeah.
That's so cool. That's
it
so
is.
Exciting.
It is. It's really amazing. Did you ever, like, talking about the evolution of your recovery, did you ever sort of, like, after you did a year and you were like, wow, I feel good, I'm going to keep doing this, was there ever a point where you went, maybe I've had enough. Like, maybe I don't want to keep moving forward in recovery. Maybe I'm going to go back to drinking.
No. Honestly, I decided about 6 to 8 months in that first year, I was like, holy shit, I'm getting so much done. I feel good. I'm spending less money. I was just listing pros after pros.
Yeah.
I was just like, why would I even consider going back? And you know, like the whole one day at a time thing, I'll still never say I'll never have another drink.
I don't either. I will never say that. That's too much.
That's terrifying. Yeah. But I can definitely say I'm not going to drink today.
Yeah.
Probably not going to drink tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I knew pretty early on.
Yeah.
This was, because I'd flirted with sobriety a lot before. I mean, before that first year, I went 3 months without it, and that was the longest time. But I would go a week or two, a month maybe. So I always knew at some point that I needed to cut back.
Yeah.
So this was the first time that it actually stuck.
Yeah, yeah. No, I used to always negotiate with myself.
Yeah, of course.
I just need to stop drinking in the morning, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
I just need to,
or I'm just going to, I'll go out, but I'm just going to have one drink tonight. And I'd ask my friends to hold me accountable. Yeah. And then I'd be on that one drink. I'd be like, okay, one drink and one shot. And, you know, and then it's, but it's
okay,
like.
Okay, drink, one shot, and one shot with a drink.
Yes. And then it's like, oh, fuck it. Let's keep going. But.
And then your friends are drunk. So they're like, yeah, fuck it.
Yeah. But I mean, at the time I was, you know, I was living back home in my hometown of Waco, Texas. I was bartending. I was hanging out with other bartenders. It's what we did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not justifying it or saying it's okay. That's just what we did.
No, and it's true. It's very common. I feel like what happens is I've always kept like this fear. It's just always, we were recently talking about this, but I am a very fear-based person. And that's one of the things that I have to work hard on in recovery. And one of the things that we talk about in 12-step, I do have a higher power, and it is not a sort of standard concept of God, but it is, I do feel like, I think of it more like the universe. And I have to consciously, still 15 years later, do what is suggested, which is to replace fear with faith, right? When I fear, I'm going to, you know, go, I'm going to pick up and I'm going to end up, you know, losing everything and doing all of that. If I can replace that with faith, that if I stay on track, I'm going to be taken care of. It's not going to, you know, it's going to work out okay.
Yeah.
It's very helpful. But I have always sort of kept that fear. And I always wonder, you know, what if someday I woke up, like, not afraid? You know?
Yeah.
I'm afraid of not being afraid. That's how fearful I am.
But that's how it is.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're not alone in that school of thought. You could always, if you start feeling fearful, you could just listen to Faith by George Michael / Limp Bizkit, and that'll take care of
it. I love that.
It'll just go away, right?
Yeah.
See, I have no fears. I never have that problem.
You're much more fearless than I am. Totally.
I have fears, but my fears are, like, really dramatic.
Yeah.
Like, what I worry about is, like, having my heart broken.
Yeah.
That scares the shit out of me. Losing a loved one. Like, it's really big stuff like that. Existential stuff. But, like, I moved to New York without knowing anyone here. I didn't have anywhere to live. I just figured it out.
Yeah.
I went to Paris for 3 days and I don't know French.
Yeah.
I stuff like that, that would scare most people. That doesn't scare me.
Yeah.
But, I'm weird.
What about the music thing, though? Both of us have been heavily invested. We both have relied heavily on music as part of our recovery. Like, absolutely. What has been, has your musical, like, have things shifted for you in terms of what you listen to and inspiring your recovery or lifting you up or anything?
I will say my perspective on Jim Morrison has changed.
Really? How is that?
In sobriety. So Jim Morrison has been my almost lifelong obsession.
Ever since
I was probably 5 or 6 years old, the first time I heard Touch Me on the radio, I was hooked.
My favorite is Love Street.
Oh, that's a great song.
I love Love Street.
Beautiful song. I've been obsessed with him for most of my life. And now that I'm sober, I look at him, I listen to his words, read his poetry, watch interviews with him, and I'm just like, wow, this man was really sick. This man really needed help.
Yeah.
And he lived on an entirely different plane.
Yeah.
Like, you read his poetry and you're like, what the fuck is he talking about? And it's like, because he didn't live on Earth.
Right.
It made sense to him. And it's like at the time, when I was a kid and then while I was using, I thought it was really cool.
Right.
Like, he's the Lizard King.
I know, right.
And now I'm like, man, he was really fucked up. But I still love the Doors. Yeah. I love him. I still think he's fantastic for what he was.
Yeah.
But it's, I have a more mature perspective on Jan now.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think, you know, what happened to me pretty early on was like certain music, and particularly with lyrics, would grab me when I could tell they were about recovery, like the Counting Crows' Long December always got me. And also their song Monkey.
Oh, I don't know that song.
Oh, it's great. It's about, you know, the being, well, also look at George Michael's song Monkey. Yeah. Right?
Well, is Adam Duritz sober?
Yes.
He's sober? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so both of those, and it's funny because Adam Duritz was sober of Counting Crows a really long time, and I remember he dated Jennifer Aniston.
Courtney
and
Cox.
He dated both of them.
He did?
Yes.
Good for him, just missing Lisa Kudrow.
And I remember thinking at the time, I was not sober for that long, and I remember thinking, I wonder what it's like for them to date, or particularly with Courtney Cox, I guess I was thinking about it, to date a sober person.
Yeah.
I think he dated Jennifer Aniston too. Maybe I'm getting that wrong, but... But like, I was thinking, wow, they could date whoever they want. And they're choosing to date a sober person who clearly writes about his recovery. And this was like, you know, back then in the 90s. And, you
see,
know,
a normal person wouldn't think stuff like that, you know, like that's how our minds work.
Yeah.
Where it's like sobriety, like, they always kind of made us uncomfortable in a way.
Right, and like, and people who we thought were the coolest women were dating this sober guy who sang about being sober. Like, what do? They can't go out to the bar. And I remember thinking, you know, it was just, so that, like, anything with a really clear connection to drugs or recovery or whatever it is really got me. And so now when I hear those songs, like A Long December, it makes me feel nostalgic for my early recovery.
Yes.
Because I remember how tightly I held on to those too. Oh, yeah. And they feel very, you know, it takes me right back there.
I love that. And I love that George Michael has come up twice on this podcast.
I know, isn't that funny? I loved George Michael. R.I.P. And you knew he was like in so much pain.
I know.
You know, that's why so many geniuses, so much pain and so much addiction.
Yeah. And I can't, that... coupled or paired with fame, I can't even imagine what when you're at that level,
right?
I don't even
and
know
George
how people
Michael
function.
Struggled with sobriety and struggled with recovery, which is always, and you know, just sort of wrapping up to, it brings it back all the time to that one quote, and we talked about this when we were talking about movies and all that movie Candy that I love with Heath Ledger and Abigail Cornish, and his line as he's an addict who can't, you know, sort of tries and whatever. And he says, you know, if you're given a reprieve, it's a good idea to remember how thin it is.
Mm.
And it's so true. It's an elbow reach away. And I'm just really grateful we're in this place today.
This is a good place to be.
Yes.
And this couch is very comfortable.
We love yammering on the couch.
Figuratively and literally, this is a good place to be.
So let us know, has your sobriety, recovery, attempts, anything evolved?
Yeah.
We love hearing from you.
That was a good topic. I don't remember who suggested that, but I liked that.
Thank you. And we'll see
you
next time. We would love to hear from you guys. If anybody wants to ask questions, have any discussion, comments, weigh in, you can find me at Girl Walks Out on Twitter, on Instagram, and my website is lisasmithauthor.com.
Yes, and you can find me at Tawny M. Lara, and my website is tawnylara.com. And my blog you can find at sobrietyparty.com.
That's right.
T-E-A.
Party.
I was enunciating the T, Lisa.
All right. We'll see you next time. Thanks.